To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
I think they want to be home with their kids, and I think they see a very strong value in that.
There is an old trabalengua, or tongue twister, that kids learn in Spanish. It goes like this. Mi mamá me mima mucho, which means, my mother, she spoils me a lot. On today's program, stay-at-home moms. The Census Bureau reports more of those mommies are Latinas.
What does it mean for the family's income? What does it mean for the long-range success of this family? I don't necessarily see it as a negative thing. I think it's positive, and I think it's positive that it is their choice culturally. I don't think it's their economic choice. Let's put it that way.
Also, El Sonido de la Bahía, the sound of the Bay Area in jazz, a conversation with trombonist Wayne Wallace. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. For the news this week, a focus on agriculture. In 1997, black farmers sued the federal government. They alleged widespread discrimination in the United States Department of Agriculture's farm ownership loans. The government settled that class action suit and over the next decade paid some $1 billion in damages to the black farmers. Shortly after that suit, Latino farmers who faced similar discrimination also filed a lawsuit. And although most of the facts and circumstances surrounding the black farmers were almost identical to the Latino farmers, their case has gone practically nowhere. We're joined now by NPR reporter Wade Goodwin, who's been following this issue. Welcome to Latino USA, Wade. It's your debut on our show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So give us a little bit of a history lesson. This story sounds shocking because you've got African-American farmers suing for the same exact reasons, getting a $1 billion settlement, and then you've got Latino farmers in the same situation, and their lawsuit is stuck.
Here's what happened. The black farmers had had it with the USDA. They sued, and it came out that during the Reagan administration, the USDA Civil Rights Division had been dismantled quietly. No one knew. And yet the agency encouraged farmers, women, blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans, that if they felt discriminated against, by all means, go ahead and file a complaint, where those complaints were promptly thrown into an empty room and no one ever looked at them again. I mean, there was testimony that, you know, they were strewn about the floor. A judge in the Pigford case, that's the black farmers case, found that this failure to investigate for 14 or 15 years by the government, failure to investigate these civil rights complaints constituted that the USDA themselves had constituted the black farmers into a class by treating them this way, by throwing all their complaints. And that we have a different judge for the Hispanic farmers, and he has ruled that the USDA's actions do not make the Hispanic farmers a class. Since the judge has ruled that way, the federal government has fought the Hispanic farmers every step of the way for the last 9 years, although they settled in the late 90s with the black farmers for $1 billion and have since decided to give the black farmers another $1.25 billion on top of it.
And the whole issue of being able to sue as a class is that there is no way that these individual farmers could hire lawyers, take the time, the money, et cetera, to take on the federal government, basically.
Well, you got to remember that, you know, a lot of these individual farmers aren't farmers anymore. So you have to wonder if someone has moved on with their lives and now doing something completely different, if they would even bother, you know, decades later to go to the trouble. That's why class status is so important for the farmers and for their lawyers, because without it, I mean, the prospects that 15,000 black farmers were settled with, you know, the idea that 15,000 Hispanic either farmers or previous farmers would come forward is far-fetched, I think.
All right. Now, it seems that President Obama is adding some salt to the wounds of these Latino farmers. He recently revealed that he believes that the $1 billion that the black farmers got paid in settlement was not enough. And he's asking for $1.25 billion more. And all of this while the Latino farmers have had absolutely no redress for their discrimination. So what prompted the president to kind of get involved? And do you think he's going to get involved with the Latino farmers? Can he?
Well, I mean, the extra money for the black farmers is for late filing farmers who wanted to file but haven't filed yet, But you're right. There's not been a penny for Hispanic farmers. I think the lawyers for the Hispanic farmers had hoped with the election of President Obama that things would be different from the Bush administration, which had stonewalled them every step of the way. But so far, the Obama administration has been in lockstep with the Bush administration and has decided that they are going to fight the farmers, the Hispanic farmers. What's ironic about this is that there are three judges involved in this, all from the same D.C. District Court. The judge for the black farmers has given class status, and the judge for the Native American farmers has given them class status. But the same judge who has both the Hispanic farmers and the women farmers has denied them class status. So it's a very interesting and somewhat bizarre legal situation in which it matters a great deal which federal judge was assigned your case.
Wade Goodwin, thanks so much for joining us on Latino USA. Please come back sometime, huh?
It's my pleasure.
Wade Goodwin is an NPR reporter based in Dallas. For a link to his NPR story, go to our website at latinousa.org. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We heard this news the other day, and we wanted to know more. Stay-at-home moms are more likely to be Latina, foreign-born, and younger. A new census report says that more than one quarter of stay-at-home moms are Latinas. So we called Pilar Torres. She's the founder and director of Centro Familia. It's an advocacy group in suburban Maryland that helps families with early care and education. Welcome to Latino USA, Pilar.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So when you heard about these new statistics, so many Latina mothers making the decision to stay at home with their children, what was your immediate reaction when you saw the numbers?
Well, you know, Maria, I actually think there's some good news behind this information. And one of the issues that I think we need to highlight is that it speaks to the family strength of Latino families. I think that when you have a stay-at-home mom, it usually means that there is some kind of breadwinner that allows for that to happen, even if they're low-income families, particularly if you're dealing with immigrant families that don't necessarily qualify for any benefits. So you know that there has to be a husband or some kind of partner that is providing for the family.
Let's talk about these numbers perhaps representing some bad news in terms of Latinas. And I'm thinking that there are issues of isolation of Latina mothers. Perhaps were they really making this decision for themselves, or was it kind of imposed on them? Is there a cultural pressure to, you know, be a good mama and stay at home and not further your own career and advancement?
You have to think about that you can't ignore those issues. But, you know, I think we need to be very careful with that, because I find that sometimes we, as middle-class, educated women who have maybe experienced American society, American culture, that we place values that are maybe more sort of mainstream feminist values to these women. I think they want to be home with their kids, and I think they see a very strong value in that. And I'm always very concerned about the double standard that we have sometimes in our society, that if you're a middle-class, highly educated woman who chooses to stay home, you opt out of the career treadmill or whatever. There's something interesting or wonderful about that. But when you're poor and you choose to stay home because you believe that you are the person who should be home with your children, then that decision maybe is not as wise or as interesting. So I think we have to be very careful about imposing some of these values on the families that we work with. So I can't say that I think that they're forced. But yes, we have traditional gender roles in our communities, and I think maybe it is their choice culturally. I don't think it's their economic choice. Let's put it that way.
So one of the things that you want to do is you want to bring in these women who are staying at home with their kids. You want to bring them into the world of business to become potential earners. So you help them sometimes open up daycare centers in their own homes. So when you are working with these Latina moms, and they hear that you're saying, look, you know, think about maybe starting a business. Do you see their eyes just going, bing, 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 bing? This is like the perfect marriage between staying at home and, you know, having my own business. Or are they looking at you like, no, 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 no. I have no interest in opening a business. I really just want to stay at home with my kids.
I think the women that come to us are definitely looking for something. They are desperately looking for some alternative that allows them to stay home, bring some kind of revenue into their families. And let me tell you, it is an interesting business for these families. They can make a very decent income in this business. And from the very beginning of our organization, we saw that. We understood that very clearly. And we promoted our program as a child development program. They are going to become child development teachers. We really wanted them to understand the incredible role that they're going to be playing in the lives of these kids. But we also very strongly emphasize that this is a business. They're entrepreneurs. And we give them a lot of pride and a lot of status around that.
What you're talking about, in many of these cases, Latina immigrant moms. What about Latinas who are not the new immigrants, who are, you know, they've been here 3-4 generations? Are you seeing many of these Latinas making the decision to stay at home as well? It's not just the new immigrant, but it's also the...
We have a few. Yeah, I think I would say about a quarter of the women that we're working with are that woman. But I have to say, the interesting phenomenon with that is that the first generation Latina knows English. She has bigger, broader horizons. And I think what is interesting is that those moms come to us looking for the Latina to take care of their children. Because that's another important thing that we need to think about, is that we as Latinas, and there's a lot of data around this, even when you control for socioeconomic status, we're still always seeking first our familia, our neighbors, our friends to take care of our children before we place our babies in a center. Our first choice is always, you know, our first circle of trust. Now, we do have quite a bit of women who the first generation Latinas that are going into this business as well. And the leaders in the field are actually first generation Latinas.
Pilar Torres, thanks so much for joining us to share your thoughts on this.
Thank you, Maria. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Pilar Torres is the founder and director of Centro Familia, based in Wheaton, Maryland.
Telemundo trae Doña Bárbara, la telenovela.
Telenovelas, soap operas, admit it, they can be just a little bit addictive. Imagine, though, getting your fix and learning something, too. That's the hope of the Oakland, California-based advocacy group, CEO Women. They've just produced 6 episodes of a telenovela interlaced with the how-tos of opening a small business. The telenovela is called Grand Cafe, and the organization, CEO Women, will now add soap operas to their traditional classroom training. Lonnie Shavelson has our story.
Every episode of Grand Cafe has romance, passion, jealousy.
Chock full of melodrama.
Dr. Carolina Acosta Arzuru researches telenovelas.
Heart-rending suffering in love.
And bookkeeping? That's right. Grand Cafe is a soap opera mixed with economics. The trick is, how exactly do you get people to watch a telenovela about starting your own company?
Antonio, mi amor.
That is the stunning entry of Cecilia into the Grand Cafe. 30 years old, overly made up, and provocatively dressed, she greets Antonio, a handsome and very eligible Mexican immigrant. He's not only made it good as the owner of this cafe, he's attracted Cecilia. Confident of her sensualized style and fancy clothes, Cecilia is sure she's got Antonio all wrapped up.
Antonio, you're mine!
The camera pans, and at a table nearby are 4 immigrant women. They're deep into their books on business startups.
Here's to our success as future business owners.
To us!
One of them is Sylvia, a youthful beauty even in the construction overalls she's wearing. Sylvia has a crush on Antonio, but keeps her focus on opening her own construction business. She glances at the luxurious clothing Cecilia's wearing to lure Antonio and says to her fellow business students,
I used to buy clothes. But now I think buying fancy clothes is a waste of money.
Which brings the conversation at the table to clothing. One woman asks, are work clothes tax deductible?
You just have to remember to keep your personal receipts separate from your business receipts.
And right there is a mini lesson. Keep your business receipts. Each event in the telenovela is a lesson. As each episode winds down, a business startup coach comes on screen for the lesson of the day.
Networking is talking to people about your business ideas. Practice networking.
These lessons can be as much about business English as business economics.
Now, you try. Networking.
Meanwhile, back at the Grand Café. So who will win Antonio's heart? The flirtatious Cecilia or the career-focused Sylvia? Here's Antonio as he serves coffee to Sylvia.
I think you really have to love what you do if you are starting a business. You have to persevere to be an entrepreneur. You can't give up. You have to believe in yourself.
We in the business world have lost our attractiveness to women. So that's the first challenge. We are losing women.
Dr. Kelly McElhaney is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Professor McElhaney says a telenovela is good marketing to reach immigrant women interested in opening their own businesses, but asked if she thinks this may be playing into a stereotype of reaching out to women through a love story. She said no.
I don't know if it talks down to women or if it just talks about issues that women are interested in. Things like family, relationships, love, things like children. So to me, the assumption there is that a telenovela somehow denigrates a woman's intellectual capacity. I think it just speaks to different sides of a woman's intellectual capacity.
Diana has had a hard life. She was a successful bookkeeper, but now she's a single mom in a new country. Rather than seeing this as a barrier to starting a business, she sees it as an opportunity.
Maybe Sylvia, the young entrepreneur in overalls, should have the last word. I found her on the film set for The Grand Café. She's played by Sophia Ahmad, who says she's mixed Caucasian and Pakistani. She learned her Spanish accent to play Sylvia by hanging out in San Francisco's Mission District. She says that Sylvia's interest in Antonio is one of the major business and life lessons of this telenovela.
Antonio is the first guy in a really long time who sits and asks her questions about what she does. He doesn't judge what she does. He's interested. He's supportive. Sees her for who she is, a self-determined woman, and respects that. This is the blossoming of a relationship that has a potential of becoming a true partnership. That support may not always be there for immigrant women trying to start their businesses, and that's huge.
Besides, she adds, remembering it's a telenovela, Antonio is really cute. For Latino USA, I'm Lonnie Shavelson.
And just a quick little notita on Latin music in the USA this week. Well, for those of you who were not watching the performance of Shakira on Dancing with the Stars, who mixed it up bilingually along with Asian-inspired drummers and Arab-styled dancers, if you missed that, it might have been because you were watching President Obama mixing it up with Thalia on a dance floor in the White House. The stars were there, Jimmy Smits, Eva Longoria, even Gloria Estefan, who was partying with a presidente who wants to open up a dialogue with Cuba. I just love the thought of salsa and merengue and reggaeton reverberating off the walls of the White House and making our past presidentes shimmy from their stiff portraits. Que viva la música. In a minute, Desde la Bahía, a conversation with a pillar of Bay Area jazz, Wayne Wallace, coming up on Latino USA. Quédense con nosotros. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. When you think of Afro-Cuban music, maybe the trombone is not the first instrument that comes to mind. But the trombone has always been essential in order to make a band really swing. And no one embodies that axiom more than San Francisco's Wayne Wallace. The 3-time Grammy nominee is an accomplished composer, arranger, educator, and of course, bandleader. His latest album is entitled Bien Bien, and Wayne Wallace joins us now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Latino USA, Wayne.
Thank you, Maria. Good morning.
So I was revealing to you a little bit of my East Coast, New York-based, centric kind of notion about jazz. But the reality is, for someone like you, who was born and raised in San Francisco, jazz is a happening music on the West Coast, and San Francisco is one of those thriving places. So am I getting it right? I mean, is jazz in San Francisco hot, 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 hot?
It's not New York hot, 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 hot. There's an intensity that no other place can match from a New York standpoint of jazz. The scene in San Francisco has a history that goes back and parallels the New Orleans scene in its red light district in Storyville. We narrow out here called the Barbary Coast.
Interesting.
And so we share a history here, and it's not really written about a lot or talked about. But I'd be the first one to agree with you. Nothing compares with New York jazz.
So for you, where did your relationship to jazz come from?
My parents. They introduced me to Nat King Cole. They had a Charlie Parker record and Louis Jordan records around the house. And it was one of those things that was implanted at an early age. And as time went on, I just kept gravitating to jazz, even though I was playing R&B in a James Brown band and doing different things, touring here in California in kind of a top 40 band.
My God, Wayne Wallace, you have played with Aretha Franklin, you've played with Whitney Houston, you've played with Tito Puente, you've played with one of my top all-time favorite groups, Earth, Wind & Fire, but you always come back to jazz because...
Yeah.
Because why?
Jazz, it's a wellspring that just kind of keeps feeding into itself. If there's a nexus of creativity, for me it's jazz. And you're just walking that tightrope, and you're either going to sound great or you're going to suck. You know, the variables are very narrow. And I just love that because it keeps you young. It keeps you sharp. It makes you think. It inspires the people around you who come to hear the music. It inspires conversation, spirituality, everything.
And you know, the title cut is Bien Bien, and it's such an inviting song, and yet you've got some definitely funky percussion going on there. But I also was taken because I don't know if I've ever heard this combination of the words, Bien Bien. It means good, good, but to you, Tell me about the title cut and what Bien Bien means to you.
Well, it was interesting when I wrote that song. I wanted to write something that was just happy, just had a good happy feeling to it. And after I wrote it, I started thinking about a lot of times when I think about when, if you don't speak Spanish really well and someone asks how you're doing, ¿cómo estás? You go, most of them go, bien, bien. So I just went like, it's just happy. In the song, that's why I put it as the first tune on the record, because it was the happiest tune on the record.
So you're saying that people say, ¿cómo estás? And you say, bien, 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 bien.
Bien, bien, estoy bien.
Decided to do something that is, it's not something that I've heard a lot, but on the song Solid, You say Latin jazz has become an artistic given for almost all cultures. Mm-hmm. St. Thomas showed us how well calypso and jazz could work together. So mm-hmm. here in this song, it's Sonny Rollins, blues, cubop, and you decided that you wanted to bring in calypso into the mix.
The thing about jazz in its early inception is that it was always a type of music that was dance music. When I look at Solid, I think Sonny Rollins really brought that to light. The 50s and the 60s were a big turning point where jazz became more of a visceral, integrative thing again. It kind of, with bebop, it became very intellectual. You stopped dancing to it. The swing era had ended. And Sonny Rollins was one of the progenitors, along with the hard bop era, to bring that back again. And with Solid, I just wanted to pay homage to the fact that you can play a blues and it can still be a Latin tune. Calypso, of course, falls in that category also. But it's not literally calypso, but I just wanted to really kind of tie those ends together.
So, Wayne, where does, in this mix of music that you've got going on, Latin jazz, for you, means what?
Rhythm. Rhythm. The folkloric music, the Afro-Cuban folkloric music from Santeria has... Everything changed for me once I started to understand or get a better grasp of what that music was about.
You mean the songs that are played for the santos, mm-hmm, the orishas, mm-hmm, the saints, mm-hmm, in Cuba? Mm-hmm. Those are often played in rarely in a professional setting.
Right.
But this is something that you saw and it spoke to you.
Yes, very much so. That started with working with John Santos. And we would take the cantos, and most of those songs, I have to say all of them, don't have chords. So it gave me a chance to harmonize them and then to actually put grooves to them also, too. It's just interesting to me how they all, it meshes. At a certain point, as when you think of a bata drum and that the counterpoint that's going on between the three drums, how horn lines and a bass line can all work together to make a unified sound with totally disparate parts that, you know, just jive together.
Well, Wayne Wallace, thank you for bringing in together all that unified sound, because it's definitely working, and we're so happy that you joined us on Latino USA.
Thank you very much.
Wayne Wallace's latest album is entitled Bien Bien, and it's available from Patois Records. Thanks again so much, Wayne Wallace.
Thank you, Maria. It's a real honor and a pleasure to be here.
And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Latino USA is produced by Walter Morgan, Mincho Jacob, Angela Maldonado, Alex Avila, and Katie Davis. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. By Lumber Liquidators, supporter of the National Braille Press and Ronald McDonald House Charities. Hardwood flooring catalogs at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.